Welcome to the Space Cave. I'm David Huntsberger. Sounds like a hotel room in Boise, Idaho today. Nice and quiet. The Tree Fort Music and Comedy Festival is happening in the distance. Pull up a tasty beverage and join in. I never say tasty beverage. I don't know why I suddenly felt compelled to there. Anyway, the shows have been fun so far. I'm recording this before the festival is over. But by the time you hear this, it has ended. And I'm assuming the final two shows went well. The Friday early show was a little bit of a drunk crowd, but otherwise it's been really great. A lot of funny comedians from all over, Washington, Oregon, someone even drove in from South Dakota, all for the love of the game, just to do comedy. So it's been fun watching them. Let's check in with a citizen from planet Earth.
Hello, this is Andy.
Andy, hello. It's David Huntsberger from the Space Cave.
David, hello. Thanks for calling.
Of course, yeah. I see in your message that I had missed you previously, so I'm glad we finally synced up on our schedules.
I'm glad you graciously called me again. I'm sure it's frustrating when people send their numbers to and they don't pick up.
Well, I can understand because I would assume it's some bizarre area code that shows up on their ID, so maybe they think, oh, crap, I owe someone money. And maybe they don't answer. And then if I didn't leave a voicemail, then you have no idea who called you. So anyway, we've moved past that.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. Are we recording now?
We are currently recording. So that sentence, that question you just asked me, will continue on into the annals of human history.
Beautiful. Beautiful. One thing that I've done today is actually I've been reading a book about a Greek book by Archimedes. And the story of the book is kind of about how it survived through time. So it made me think about, you know, how much of current TV and pop culture and recordings are going to survive and kind of by what means they'll do so, whether they'll last 100 years or 1,000 years. So it's interesting to think about. What do you think?
Man, yeah, that is right off the top. Just that I think about that quite a bit in that, like, our human interactions, and, you know, through comedy, people are nervous about doing open mic. And I always say to them, like, people aren't going to remember if you do poorly. They barely remember if you do well. And yet, then again, there are sentences people have said in my life, just random sentences of someone where I will think of it from time to time. And I don't know why, like, of all the multitude of things that have been crammed into my head, why is it that one kid saying that thing in that weird way when I was 10 that I'll always kind of think of? And so, like, our minds are these little hard drives that are selective. Maybe the whole existence is the same way. Certain statues make it through, certain weird bits of porcelain make it through, the fossils that make it through. They end up defining a culture and what was around, and yet other things kind of, you know, it'll be weird digitally, you know, like with Johnny Carson having that vault of all of the Tonight Shows buried underground in, I think, Kansas, and maybe never releasing the rights to them. Maybe that'll just be a thing that is this capsule that never gets reopened and people don't know it ever existed in a few hundred years, and yet people might, I don't know what else, you could drop some sort of terrible,
yeah, or I mean maybe just something that someone happens upon without knowing or expecting it, like, you know, I think of, like, the Dead Sea Scrolls, how those kind of just appeared from a farmer, right? Like, or a shepherd who kind of just was crawling around this cave and figured out that all these old documents were there.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on, is it important? You know, do you want your life to be, I think we all have this feeling that, you know, when you see someone who will just run around and be naked and say dumb stuff, they kind of on a fundamental level understand it doesn't matter. None of this is really going to affect anything. It's just my life, and I'm to take it so seriously. Like, I've always got to be, oh no, I have food in my teeth, oh crap, I have toilet paper trailing the back of my foot, now everything's ruined. No one's like jotting this stuff down. No one's chiseling it into nothing. None of it's going to matter. So what are your thoughts on like why things matter, what you want to last?
Well, I think memories are important. And I think that my brain is so fickle that I wish I wrote more things down. Mm-hmm. In terms of like remembering how I felt at certain times in my life, remembering the years when I was happier, the years when I was sadder, because it's hard, like when you're up, to look back and think on, you know, why am I up right now? Why am I happy? And also the reverse is true, you know, being able to remember how you felt at certain low points, I think is valuable. I don't think that it's valuable universally. Like it might not be valuable for people in the future to know how I feel. But I think that it's something that's important to reflect on. That was actually one of my goals on my checklist for today, was set up a plan for this year to try to basically just record feelings and memories, my own feelings and memories, just a bit more carefully.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's always something that I do, but I journal so sporadically. I don't know how you do it or how you keep that discipline.
When this helps, like, and not to think of this as just some bin I go throw all my thoughts into, but there is like, you know, with, I think creativity, Jim Carrey used to like go look in the mirror when he was down, when he was really ebullient, just regardless, whatever emotion he was feeling, he'd go study his face in the mirror so that he could figure out how to recreate that later on. And for someone who's like both parents passed away and had a lot of like emotional turmoil and things that he could mine to bring up to find those emotions, we all have them. I mean, the spectrum might not go that deep, and hopefully not, but to be aware of them, I think that's smart of you to jot them down. I don't know that I do a great job of doing it. I sort of process what I'm experiencing in the world and why, but I don't necessarily... I don't know if I do a great job of going, you know, when I am a little down, going, why is this happening? What am I feeling right now? Where'd this come from? And I don't know that I always chronicle it. And so like I could go back through like a database. I'm like, peanut butter. Never eat peanut butter on the Wednesday. That's what did it last time.
Yeah, fair enough. It's funny. There's a kind of short play called Crap's Last Tape, which is about a guy who records himself talking every single day of his life, and the play is kind of him as a very old man, and he's going, you know, through the tapes and kind of fast forwarding and rewinding certain days, and you know, kind of all these jokes, like he's just always eating bananas and he's always, you know, huffing and puffing around the stage. But I think that it's a funny play. It ends up being a funny play in my mind because of how, you know, similar a lot of the days are, how kind of meaningless the tapes are to everyone but him. Have you seen it? Or if not, maybe check it out.
What's the name of it?
What you think.
Paps?
It's called Crap's Last Tape.
Crap's Last Tape.
K-R-A-P-P.
Oh, okay. Last Tape. Okay, yeah, I'll check that out. Because I think when things like that, when people have weird idiosyncrasies or even like affectations, they kind of like convey an element that they think their life is very important. I think the rest of us, when we just see that, that becomes who they are completely. We don't watch the tapes and go, oh, I know that guy. We just hear the story and go, oh, the tapes guy. Like that becomes the legacy of their entire life. So there's not really going to be a biographer trailing us around. There's probably not going to be someone. Like I was in Edinburgh, Scotland, in November, and we went to this cemetery. And people's names chiseled in stone where you would think, well, it's locked in there. They're so old, it barely even looks like natural time and water has affected rock. It looks so unlike a gravestone because it's just been worn down through the ages that's going to happen to everything, where you could kind of make out like, they used to say someone's name. It just barely now looks like little ripples, and they're vaguely similar to, you know, letters, but you couldn't make it out. They're just worn down so much, and that feels like what inevitably happens to everything.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, just like in terms of thinking about what lasts in the world, one thing that really important people get is really like big graves so that everyone remembers them. Like, I went to Graceland maybe a year or 2 years ago, and Elvis's, you know, grave is something that will probably live forever, at least as long as people will go and see it as a tourist attraction. Same thing with like Napoleon's grave, or, you know, maybe even the pyramids is like the first example.
Yeah, the Mormons have that temple, and then they also have that underground sort of bomb shelter that could survive a direct impact from a nuclear warhead and survive. So I think it's going to be there for a long time. And if there is civilization, be it humans or whatever, in thousands of years, that's what's going to last. It's certainly not going to be this digital stuff. And sadly, our conversation right now probably won't make it through. Unless maybe sadly those Mormons.
Sadly not. One thing that maybe some people, maybe that I'm jealous of you about, though, is that you do have kind of a log, you know, between the Professor Blastoff podcast and these podcasts where, you know, even if you don't go back to listen to them, wouldn't imagine that you do. Someone like me can go back and see, you know, what was David like 3 years ago or however many years ago when that whole thing started.
Yeah.
So the work that you put in for yourself ends up kind of creating a nice log, which is cool.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, it's as it came to be more of a common thing, it really appealed to me, I think probably because of that. Like, oh, this is, you know, you create whatever it is, a comic or a stand-up CD or something that takes a while and it sort of exists in anonymity and then you release it into the world. This idea of charting as you go through, it's just interesting. Thoughts are, I think people having a desire for the world to kind of stay in a certain place, that would be nice, but the change always allows new conversations and new ideas to be had, philosophies on what is happening. And so that gives me some comfort knowing, like, oh, it's always going to be kind of baffling. It's always going to be perplexing.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like you keep my brain moving. I enjoy listening to, you know, all the guests that you have on this show, Space Cave. And I think that this format gives you a little bit more room to, like, ask, you know, good questions and talk about the things that you're interested in. And I'm really into it.
Well, thanks, man.
I listen to it mostly when I'm jogging.
Oh,
my
okay.
Friends make fun of me because they all listen to, you know, hip-hop tunes or things that are motivational. For me, it's as good a time as any to kind of listen to, you know, musings about the universe.
Yeah, I agree. At some point, I'm probably going to start cutting those sort of sentiments out of these conversations. Nothing against you, but it's like it'd be just strange if I left those in repeatedly. And like, do people love this show, guys? People are fond of it. But I appreciate the positive feedback, and I'm glad you're enjoying it.
I don't know how long this has been. I'm sure you have a better cadence of it than I do.
Yeah, I gotta wind it up. But good luck with the rest of the Archimedes book, and check back in maybe later in the year and see, and you can read back to us, the collective group within the cave, what your emotions were on certain days. Maybe I'll pick a certain day and see if you chronicled that and how you were feeling.
Ooh, that would be interesting. That would be an interesting test, because then if I hadn't, you know, written anything down that day, then it would just be a total failure. but if I had recorded that day, then it would be an interesting sort of experiment and sampling. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I will try to hold you to that. So if that's any incentive to do it, that's the best I can do.
Take care. This is a great incentive. I like this little agreement that we've made.
Perfect. All right, cool. Well, thanks, Andy. At Andy Fancy Pants. Follow him on Twitter. Talk to you later this year, my friend.
All right.
See ya.
Thanks, dude.
Well, we'll have to check back in down the road and see if Andy kept up with his journal and what transpired in that. So nice talking to him. Nice talking to anybody who wants to chat on the show. So thanks to Andy for sharing his number. And if you follow space_cave, you can respond whenever now and again. I'll write or send a tweet out saying who wants to chat. Let's get to part two with Jason Rabinovich. He is a brilliant guy from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. He's had a cool career, as you heard a little bit of in the first one. We talk more about that here while sharing some Avatar Jasmine IPA from Elysian Brewing in Seattle. I think in the episode we kind of just talk about the jasmine flavor, but the more I drank it, the more it grew on me. I think both of us too started to enjoy it more and more. So if you haven't tried it, it's interesting at first. When you first drink it, you'll hear us talk about it. Anyway, here's part two, me and Jason Rabinovich. Back with Jason Rabinovich. We both just tried this new Elysium Avatar Jasmine, and we both went,
interesting.
Interesting. It really doesn't taste like other beer I've had.
It's got a flavor to it.
There is, now that it's been across my palate and had a few seconds to linger, there's something that reminds me of like fancy soap, but not in a bad way. Not like, because when you think of that, you go, oh, I don't want to drink that. There's just a smell or something to it that's kind of,
it's
like
not that.
That
jasmine hint of taste like flowers going for it.
Yeah, but I don't mind it. It's when I think of it, it's weird. Something's happening right now, this disconnect between my mind and what I just smelled and tasted and the thoughts I associate with that normally. Because as I was drinking, I'm like, this is good. And then as I think about it after, I'm like, that was not good.
This tastes like soap, but it doesn't.
No, it doesn't. Yeah, I like it. Yeah, I'm into it. I like this. Elysium. I've never had any of their beers, but that's two good ones. Space Dust last time, and now this delicious Jasmine Avatar. Well, so want to just get right back into, because if this is the first one you're listening to, go back and listen to the first one with Jason. Your story to me in your trajectory to get to where you are is similar to, I think if I were talking with a musician who went, yeah, and then I was just here and I got picked up by this band and I played with them for a while. And then, what was that band? That was the Rolling Stones? Yeah, I played with them for a bit. And it just, you kind of have these amazing, living in Paris for a year and going to CERN and sailing on the sailing team at Yale. I don't know why that gets thrown in, but it's just like kind of a cool aside. And that there was a level of there's a like a dignity to it, that it wasn't sailing at Yale. It's like, no, it's fun, it was cool.
Yeah, I didn't know Yale had a sailing team before I went to the school.
Yeah, that's what college is for. You're supposed to have cool experiences. And
yeah,
why not get into sailing? I bet a lot of people don't do it because they think, like, I can't be on the Yale sailing team.
Well, there was some. I mean, I got, like, because I had sailed at my summer camp before, and then this just seemed like fun. And then I walked onto the team and then got yelled at a lot by the coach and was like, all right, I'm going to learn quickly or else I'm going to get kicked off the team. So yeah, let's do that.
Do you pay attention to that cup where they sail around?
The America's Cup? I do now.
There's probably someone who's involved in that world from your school, at least. Maybe not your team directly.
From the school, yeah. I mean, right now we have some, there's always a few Olympians and stuff like that in the sailing world. I mean, right now those boats too are more engineering than sailing, so they're pretty awesome. They're just like, they're winds. They're like, take an airplane and put it on its side and go really fast. So
nice.
It's fun sport to watch now.
And I mean, what do you design? Like, what do you in your free time like to, is there something where you, I always think in movies, that's what a guy does that's watching. There's a retired CIA guy that sends in blueprints for like, here's how you find this guy. Or there's the retired, you know, jet propulsion person who goes, here, you got your thrusters in the wrong place. Here you go.
It fits it like this.
Yeah.
You know, these days I actually don't have enough free time to really do anything meaningful.
Okay. So how long have you been at JPL?
I've been there for about a year and a half or so. I started in September 2014.
Okay. And can you give like a brief history, like if you were walking people through the halls of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, what you would say, like, here's where it was started, here's why it was started, here, things just of that general nature.
So to be brief, essentially, a long time ago, there was a professor at Caltech, Theodore von Karman, who had a few grad students who wanted to start launching rockets and making rocket fuel and all these fun things. And then they started actually doing it, and explosions started happening. They realized that this stuff is really dangerous. The school started calling them, well, the other students started calling them the suicide squad, essentially. They basically blew up a basement of a building, and then the administration stepped in and was like, all right, this can't happen on campus anymore. You know, you're going to kill someone. Luckily, no one was injured. And essentially, they kicked them out to the desert, into the Arroyo, and that's how JPL was founded. These grad students, they wanted to launch rockets, and so they moved out there, and that's why it's called the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And the original use of these rockets, it's JATO, so jet-assisted takeoff. So basically, they would strap these rockets to the wings of airplanes, and then they could take off on a shorter runway. So if you want on an aircraft carrier or for a really fast takeoff, these rockets would help planes take off.
I had just, someone sent me an article or I saw it posted somewhere, that story. And I thought, there's no way that's true. And
that's entirely true.
That's so great. I love that so often people see their kids doing stuff and they only recognize what's harmful or bad or dangerous about it. And that's the end of it. And I love, you know, when a parent goes, There's actually some. This is good. Let's just lose the bleach. Stop drinking that. But
yeah, let's just. If you blow up a rocket, you're just going to hurt yourself, not everyone else. So yeah, go do that in the desert. You're fine over there.
And so, what are the majority of your projects just as a company? You know, they're not all spaceships, are they?
They're not all. I mean, the majority of our work is robotic exploration. So we're lucky. We're one of the NASA centers in the U.S. We're a little bit different. I'm technically a Caltech employee. I'm not an employee of the U.S. government because Caltech isn't. It's an FFRDC, a federally funded research and development center.
So okay.
An acronym because NASA loves acronyms.
Do you know Kim Bowman?
I do not.
Oh, okay. I'll have to introduce you. Hello, Kim. She has been really helpful, and like she works at Caltech,
awesome.
Yeah, directed a few people toward this show from that. So yeah, love Caltech, love the people there. You're an employee technically of Caltech, but you work in Pasadena.
But we work at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Okay,
and then so. I mean, the great thing about being at JPL is we're not for profit. So we're not trying to sell things or anything. Our major customer is the U.S. government, and they give us money to, you know, put a rover on Mars, which is a great place to
be. And they don't necessarily give you a directive like, here's the money to make exactly what we want. They'll say, we want a rover. See what you can come up with.
It depends. Okay. Some missions they're called directed missions. So it would, you know, the direction might be you're going to land a rover on Mars. They're not going to explicitly tell you, you have to do this science experiment, this science experiment, this science experiment. But the scope is fairly narrow. Other missions we propose to NASA. So we say, you know, we want to do this. Please give us $1 billion and we'll do that for you.
And how do you come up with that as a team?
It depends on the mission. Sometimes it's a little bit easier. So one of the they're called competed missions because different people can apply and then the winner gets the money. There's something called the Decadal Survey for Planetary Science. And it will basically say, you know, scientists have summarized where we want to go. If you have a $1 billion class mission, you should go to one of the following 5 targets. Land on Venus, go back to the moon, go to Saturn, things like that.
Okay.
And then you're like, all right, well, let's work on Venus. I'm going to propose Venus.
Is that a dart throwing thing or like you all show of hands like Venus, everyone for Venus? Let's do it.
All right. It's a little more strategic. You know, sometimes as an institution, we'll decide, oh, we actually want to propose to all of the targets, so let's submit our proposals. Or you can be like, well, we're really good at this kind of technology. That technology is well suited for this planet. We want to do that. We have a lot of experience with Mars. JPL does all of the robotic exploration missions to there. So
nice. And so something like Planet 9, which I hope we have renamed by the time this podcast
comes
out. So mathematically, there's a very good chance it exists in this strange orbit.
Right.
When you guys hear about something like that there, one, are you going, it's ridiculous? Or do you say, cool? Or do you say, how can we go take photos of it? What can we do in our job to...
Well, my first response upon hearing that was, yeah, like, how can we observe this? And like, who's going to start doing that? Yeah, I mean, that really interesting... you know, theory, discovery, whatever you want to call it, especially by, so Constantine, who's a relatively new prophet, Caltech, and Mike Brown, who's can be credited with killing Pluto, depending on who you ask. So he's very happy to discover another planet.
I hope they definitively, whether it's, I guess mathematically they've done about as much as we humanly can do, other than maybe some lensing or some sort of light that it passed in front of that we could say definitively, okay, there it is. Now we saw it. But I hope they do stamp it and say it's real, in that we lived in a time where there were 9, then 8,
and then 9
again.
Incredible. And it's a different one. It's not like, oh, no, it's Pluto's still a planet. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, it's like managing a baseball team.
It's an amazing discovery. And, you know, part of their intent of publishing that paper, which is a theoretical paper, was like, you know, for everyone in the observing community, let's see if we can actually see this thing and find it.
Uh-huh. And so you guys are on board with that. Like, were there a lot of discussions? So like the last one we left off talking a little bit about like the philosophical discussions you guys have within. Is there a part of you that says, man, we thought we had our own solar system kind of down. Like we're looking into other galaxies. We can see the oldest known galaxy, you know, dating back to the Big Bang. I mean, we're starting to get a good sense of our universe, let alone right here in our own backyard. There's a loose dog running around and we missed it.
This one we haven't talked about too much as a group. I've talked about it with a few people. And it's funny, no one's all that super surprised because we're kind of used to the more you work in the industry, the more you realize you really don't know that much conclusively. So it's like, oh, there's another planet. It's like, well, that's possible. Space is big. Like, it's really far away. It's in a really weird orbit. Like, it has something like a 10,000-year orbital period. So we're like, yeah, no, we wouldn't have known about that one. Like, all right, but I hope it's there.
Which means that we're a little bit ahead of ourselves with having, like, you know, space centers where we can say, here is our known solar system, and in potentially 5,000 years, if humans are still around, they'll look and just crack up, like, they thought there were at one time 8 planets. That's absurd.
Well, I mean, at one point as the human race, we thought that the sun orbited around the Earth, right? So if, you know, people that far in the future are looking back at us, oh, they thought there were 8, 9 planets, and then 8, then 9, they were so wrong. There's like 25.
Because I think with Galileo and Bruno, people, you look back kind of, how did they, the same thing would hold true 5,000 years from now. They, like, mathematically they discovered planet 9, which I'm hoping it has a new name, but at that point, you know, like, or planet 30 or however many are out there. It does it make people feel that way, like, oh, they, when people, like, you know, someone will have that weird planet X comes by every 1,000 years, and then we go, ah, that's ridiculous, we would have seen it. But what if? I mean, what if they...
I mean, I think it's great that it opens up a lot of doors for those what-if questions. And it is humbling, too, when you're like, yeah, we thought we knew a lot of stuff. We think we're advanced. And then you're like, yeah, there might be another planet just sitting out there. So it kind of takes you down a notch, right? Let's start thinking again. There's a lot more to discover, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's motivating. It motivates you to work harder and see what else is out there.
Yeah. I think people are so... They romanticize... Obviously, going to the moon as, you know, coming out of this war and prior to that, this depression. And this is America. This is what the United States, this is where we really band together. Let's get to the moon. It's a sort of feeling, that emotion, that concept is still alive. I mean, do you guys feel that on a daily basis? Like, yeah, we got to go find new planets and we got to find a way to get to them.
I'd say so. It's a little bit different. I mean, we don't have the Cold War motivating us right now. So it's, you know, entirely more of a scientific, exploratory.
But it's almost more genuine that way, right?
Motivation. Yeah, I would say so. It's more just, I mean, it might not give you, you know, to be blunt, it might not light the same fire under your ass as being like, oh, we have to beat the Soviets or something like that. You know,
yeah.
They weren't really trying to get to the moon. But it's more, as you said, more kind of not pure, but an easier motivation that it's really scientific discovery. There's a ton more out there and let's keep working and see what we can find out.
It must be so refreshing for you to work somewhere where there is not someone there like, oh, goddamn, benefits got cut and guns against Jeff's down my neck. I mean, I didn't need to work here. Why am I? Is everyone pretty genuinely happy to be there and excited?
Yes and no. I mean, at the end of the day, it is still a job. So you do meet some people who might be more on that scale, and you do have to deal with inner office politics. And there's people who will love to complain about, you know, this hasn't been repaired, the printer isn't working, stuff like that. So yeah. It does share very many of the same aspects of a standard 9-to-5 job.
Okay.
But at the same time, it is nice because most people, they're not motivated by salary 100%. They're there because they really like what they're doing. They're really passionate about it. And on the most part, you know, they're really good at what they do. So it's a really encouraging and vibrant environment to work in for that.
That's cool. And what is your exact title?
I have a very boring title right now, and it's mechanical engineer.
It all comes full circle.
Yeah.
Right back to
started there, have a few other degrees, and then mechanical engineer.
What are some of the other titles of people walking by you?
None of them are very creative. It's from mechanical engineer, systems engineer, technologist. Oh, okay. You know,
so there's no one that's like first corporal of aeronautical design and functionality.
You get like interesting, like head of Mars exploration and stuff like that. So those people.
That's got a sting.
I mean, that's my title. I'm in the entry, descent, and landing and formulation group, which is a mouthful, but also an interesting title.
That's what I would describe myself as when people are coming. Hello, Jason, mechanical engineer. Hi, I'm Carl, head of Mars exploration.
That's rough. Entry, descent, landing.
Yeah, I would say, entry, EADL.
EDL.
EDL. Well, you don't, yeah, you would include the and. EDL. Yeah, yeah, do people say that? Like, I'm EDL.
Yeah, well, so EDL is an acronym you hear a lot. So it's just essentially getting a spacecraft from the top of an atmosphere or near a planet down to the surface safely.
Oh, okay. As a group, did you watch The Martian? Do you care much for things like that?
I watched The Martian with a with a bunch of JPLers. So, I mean, everyone lights it. I mean, there was a huge conversation on Lab a week or two after it came out. Like, what was your favorite part? What was your least favorite part? Like, what didn't you think was realistic? And, like, everyone has their small nitpicks that, like, oh, you know, the seals on his helmet for his spacesuit, like, it was way too easy to take it on and off or stuff like that. And all, you know, probably true, but minor details. I think, on the whole, we all enjoyed it.
Okay, good. Because I think that you don't strike me as a nerd. I know it's really popular nowadays to say, like, I'm such a nerd. And working at JPL, I think, would qualify as, like, well, if you need a patch or a stamp or something to say, like, you're a real nerd. And I hope that that's not offensive to say you're not a nerd. Because I mean, think, like,
it's such a weird definition these days. Like, you know, I'm huge into math and science and space exploration. That's what I do. It's what I love. I also play sports. I also like to stay athletic. I snowboard, stuff like that. So I also like to go out and drink a beer. So
those to me seem like the, I don't know when the concept of being a human, and particularly like a male, meant more like, you gotta like trucks and you gotta sit on a recliner at night and drink light beer and that's a man, and anyone that's out being active and thoroughly engaging their mind and their body is, well, a nerd. I don't but at JPL, are there those guys, those dandruffy guys, pocket protectory guys that are going, well, here's for the problem with the Martian, it actually hit it. Are there those guys?
I mean, so when I was a grad student at Caltech was definitely worse for that. Like, there got to a point where I, you know, couldn't really watch the Big Bang Theory anymore, because it's like, well, I've met so many Sheldons in my life. And so you're like, and that's some of my coworkers. And it's fine. You know, it's great.
So you're navigating, you know, the term, I guess, is the spectrum a lot. You're seeing a lot of components of it.
Yeah. We had some jokes based on that at grad school that I won't repeat here.
All right. That's polite of you. But everyone, I mean, do you have to take courses and seminars and, like, here's how you deal with people? Here, your people skills, all of you, are lacking.
So that's a funny question, because we would get emails every so often at Caltech with titles and bodies essentially saying, like, do you have trouble meeting people? Do you have trouble talking to people about non-research-related things? Do you not leave your lab? Come to a seminar. We'll help you socialize. We'll help tell you how to small talk and talk to other people. And, like, you get those emails and just put your head down. And, like, it'd be a frustrating day. You know, whatever you're trying to do isn't working. You're like, what did I do? Like, why did I make these life choices?
And you see it's not a mass email. It's just to you.
And that would be the worst. You're like,
Jason, we don't know how to say this. We tried to send you a binary message.
What's your confidence, social confidence level at?
How's the dating scene been for you? Are you married?
I'm single right now. You know, it's dating in LA, I've found, is an interesting thing. I've had my fair share of long relationships, and then on the dating apps every so often, and see how that goes.
And you were saying, like, between our episodes, that, you know, like, you'll maybe take a Saturday off, but Sunday you'll be back in the lab, like, at work. I mean, that's got to make it tough. Where, you know, I heard a quote recently where someone said something to the effect of, like, obsessed is a term that lazy people use to describe the determined, or something like that. You know, are you just, you focus on your, you want to solve these things, you want to be good.
Right now, you know, my work-life balance is entirely skewed towards work. And I'm fine with that right now. I like working on the problems I'm working on. There's a ton of stuff to get done. I don't think this is sustainable or something I want to, you know, work this many hours for the rest of my life. But I liked what I'm doing, so I'm willing to put in the hours.
Yeah.
But it definitely made the dating life hard because of that.
And do you have, you know, like a and not to say like a life goal necessarily, but is there a vision of yourself in the future that, you know, so like you kind of assessed your career you wanted to have in your education and put a plan in place to achieve that. Is that something you think about with your overall life? Is there like, I got to the end of my life and I checked off all these things. I got there.
I definitely don't have a checklist. I definitely am not one of those people who needs to, you know, plan everything out and be like, I need to do this by age 30, this by 35, this by 40. For me, it's more if I liked what I'm working on and continually learning at my job, which is the big one for me. And then, you know, some semblance of a work-life balance that I'm still working on just to enjoy my life at the same time. And then that's what's really important to me. And, you know, the second I'm not learning or I'm really not aligned with the long-term goals of what I'm working on, and you know, I'll try something new and figure something else out.
So you're pretty, I mean, that's got a scientist would be well equipped for things like that, of like, you know, if you're repeating a pattern and it's not successful, alter it, try again. So that could be, I guess that could be very, do you struggle with like the enormity of life itself? I mean, you know, when you guys were talking about having, or you were saying you guys talk about the philosophical discussions involved with, I mean, no one's pointed more toward space than you guys. You're seeing how big the world is out there regularly. And does that weigh on you? The purpose of life? Why are we here? Do you know?
It's, yeah, I mean, you get, I don't know, for me personally, I get down that track every so often. And then I just kind of have to bring it back a bit. All right, so I mean, I don't know why I'm here. I'm probably not going to figure out the answer to that question in my lifetime. So, like, while I'm here, let's be a good person. Let's have fun. Let's enjoy what I'm doing. Let's do the best I can to, you know, better myself and learn more and feel like I'm contributing to society and to exploration. And to me, that's what's important. And it's kind of how I ended up in my job currently.
So those are, I would say, all those are ingredients to being a successful and fulfilled and happy human being. Like, enjoy it while you're, you don't know, if you spend the whole time wondering why you're here, you're going to go mad and you're not going to enjoy it. Stop looking around and look what's in front of you and take that in. So you seem to be doing that. It just seems like other people are able to do that and busy themselves in a way that is not so dancing like close to the edge like you guys are. I mean, with this exploration, with learning, with seeing how the world is made, do things come back to you sometimes where you're like, oh man, this is how the world is. This is what it's made of.
Yeah, which is a really cool, I mean, I actually like that when it comes back in that way. And when you actually understand something or learn something new, I think that's really interesting. I also think that kind of the more you know and the more like in-depth fundamental science research, it's so rare to get that feeling because you're more just like, oh, I learned about one really tiny thing in one really tiny problem that's, you know, makes up these incredibly complicated problems. It's like, well, I know more about this, but what does it mean on a global scale? No idea.
Do you concern yourself with things like politics and, you know, you say you keep up with sports a little bit, like
keep up with sports? I mean, I'm Canadian, so I can't vote in this country, unfortunately. Can I vote at home, actually, right
but
now.
But, like, say world affairs. You know, you went to Israel and you were aware of, you know, conflicts. You're aware of kind of how the world is getting along with itself. But do you get involved in those things? Are you, you know, a history buff? Do you take in, like, this world is substantial and I want to know all about it on every level?
I'm not as good as I should be on that level. I definitely try.
But why do you say, like there's an expectation that, like, you should be better? Why?
Well, because I'm interested in it and I like to learn more and know about what's going on in the world. And I do my best to get out of, like, the space kind of science bubble and at least be aware of what's going on. But, you know, there's a point of how much I can read outside of work and stuff like that. So you're like, that's when I call up, you know, go out for a beer with my history major friends, be like, what's going on? What should I know right now?
So maybe there are two parts, like the curiosity versus like the questioning on a level of, tell me history, like, I want to know this because I want to know things, as opposed to like where you're working and like, is there a quest, a chase? Like, I got to figure it out.
I guess the difference is, like, history, it's a little easier to pick up a book and just read it. And it's just the knowledge and the volume that you need to absorb and remember. And understanding, you know, is the next level. And what it implies is more complicated. And that's kind of the science aspect where it's, you're doing the exploration, you're doing the design work, you're doing the analysis. And then what does it mean? How do you apply that to something else? So it's so many pieces to the puzzle that you have to bring together.
Because someone is going to solve dark matter, dark energy, and
at
potentially,
some point. Oh, yeah.
Or maybe the space-time continuum or wormholes, or, you know, do you think things like that are plausible, feasible, time travel, maybe not teleportation, but...
I mean, so that's one of the things I really liked about Interstellar and the fact that, like, Kip Thorne was one of the advisors for it, or whatever his title was, that nothing in that movie has been proven to be impossible. So, I mean, it's on the outer realm of what's plausible and all that kind of stuff. But there's just so much to do with physics and all those things that we just don't know about. And it could very well be out there. We don't know how to control it, manipulate it, nor do we understand it. But it hasn't been disproven yet, which is really cool.
I felt people were way too hard on that movie. I feel like our technology currently matched up with a movie like that in how bold it was. Like, we can finally start showing this crazy imagination. This is saying, like, this is not just silly imagination. This is, like, hypothetically could exist. And that was amazing to see. I thought that was just unbelievable that we could be in 5,000 years on a planet where our solar system has 30 planets and we've navigated and figured out how to like sort out which one on and on. Like the plot of that movie is interesting right. in that yeah. way.
And I mean, I hope we get to that point in the future where we get some major advances in fundamental physics and we understand how to manipulate reality at its, you know, smallest level, and we can do crazy things like that.
Matthew Wielitzki was on this podcast. He's the first guest on this show, and he was one of the things we talked about, like planetary exploration was, you know, with the universe so full of asteroids and planets and, you know, ruining this planet as we think we're doing as humans, really not that substantial. It's fairly inconsequential as far as like the grand scheme of things. We're such a tiny blip if we
can get off the planet before we ruin it.
And that's where you come in. It's like, come on, guys, I know the ship we're going.
So give us NASA a little more money.
And do you feel that way? Like, do you step back and look at it that way and go, this exploration is fun, but is there this fundamental level of us being kind of a virus and this thing that is spreading and ravaging resources wherever we go, depleting them and moving on before it collapses to a different host? Do you feel that way at all? Is that too negative?
I don't get that impression, especially at JPL. You know, we focus on robotic exploration. We're a little bit removed from the human exploration. In general, also the timescales, I don't feel like, you know, I'm a complete proponent. We need to do better things to the Earth and climate change is horrible and we need to be polluting less. The time scale about...
I'm going to go ahead and disagree with you there.
We actually need to be polluting more to speed up when we need to leave. But the time scales, I don't know. I guess I don't feel like that's one of our motivations, or my motivations at least right now.
Yeah.
I mean, it definitely helps and we're aware of that problem. And the better we get with space technology, you know, the better we can be at human exploration. But also seeing the gap between where we are right now at a technological standpoint to what we would need to, you know, if we had to evacuate all humans from the Earth, we're just nowhere close to being able to do that. We just don't have the technology.
Yeah. But doesn't it seem like robotic exploration would come in a way where, like, we're not going to save humanity? But as it turns out, there are only so many souls or existences, or the probability of these chromosomes lining up in the same way again is actually reasonable. You could live the same life. So if we take some bacteria on one of these robots and plant it in a planet, it'll seem like forever in the scope of the universe. But because our notion of time is only when we are born, we will not notice that nap we took as a species.
And there's a lot of really interesting theories about that and how kind of bioengineering and biotech can be combined with space exploration to be like, well, yeah, instead of just sending a robotic mission, you know, we could take this very... almost, I'd say, aggressive attitude and say, we're going to try and seed other planets with human bacteria and things like that and be like, yeah, we'll just, you know, grow another species over there because we've destroyed this Earth. And instead of fixing it, we just want to move elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I might not necessarily agree with that, you know, approach towards colonization and exploration. But there's something to be said for, yeah, you know, what are you going to do if we don't find life on close planets, or can we spread the human race and genes to elsewhere and things mm-hmm. like that?
Yeah, because the common thing for people, I think, on this planet is to go, stop having babies. You're ruining the planet. And it's hard to disagree with that. You know, we're overpopulated. But at the same time, if we were seeding asteroids and everything out there we thought could potentially manifest into a livable condition, what's the harm in that? I mean, if we are this and we are programmed to be this, to be humans on this planet, devouring the resources, making more of ourselves, why fight that and feel bad about it? Like, no. That planet over there is meant to be pristine and just floating around.
Well, it's also kind of assuming that that's the, you know, the human mentality that we are supposed to be everywhere. This, you know,
yeah.
Just because we started on this planet, but yeah, no, that should be ours and that should be ours and that one's ours and that one's also ours now because it was close.
Yeah. Want him, need him, got him.
It's like, how highly, you know, do we think of ourselves as a species to just be like, yeah, we should be everywhere. Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, I mean, it plays into us in our egomaniacal, self-centered, the things we're so negative about in the way we look at ourselves. But if you were to be softer on that and go, all right, well, that's how we're made. I mean, it's ideal to be more zen and be a little bit more giving and thoughtful of people. And that is terrific. But it's not in our nature. I mean, we are a reptilian brain and a primitive brain and this species that want, like it or not, it's making more of itself and wants to look for new places to go. So why constantly fight that?
Which I agree with, but, you know, at the point where you're like, well, what if we don't know if there's already life on that planet, you know, yeah. and what made us have priority, because we'd be seeding it with, you know, something that's maybe comparable in its evolutionary scale, and so why should our life supersede
yeah, absolutely.
Life that already existed?
And our knowledge or, especially with DNA, you know, putting in bacteria and going, that's a crop, that's a seed, there could be something else there that is living on that planet, that thinks it is their planet, that is beyond microscopic, that we don't know, and we ruin them.
Right. And so that, and also because now we're more aware of this, I think it is our responsibility to be a little more careful before just, you know, throwing out bacteria into different interstellar planets, into different, on different exoplanets, being like, let's see what happens. I think there, we have to, you know, there, we have a little bit greater responsibility.
We look and we see it through math and maybe a distant bit of, you know, advanced physics and saying, there's a planet there. That's essentially the best we can do. And then we send you and a robotics team. We make something that can
We can't get to that planet. That's way too far for us.
What if we sent it in your lifetime and then your great-great-grandson watched it land?
Eventually, yeah. I mean, you know, I haven't looked into how far away they actually think it is right now and things mm-hmm. like that. But it's one of those things where, to me, that's where the biggest breakthrough needs to come through. It's a better propulsion system or better understanding of fundamental physics to get us to farther places quicker, because mm-hmm. now we keep it, you know, discovering all these exoplanets that are really far away and that could be really cool and things like that, but we just have no way of getting closer to there, or no way right now of doing detailed observations. So,
see, I like to hold out hope that dark matter is a sentient thing. like you're saying, the planet that we have to check and see if there's anything there we would ravage. I mean, we can't knock on their door. We can't say, hey, planet, is anyone living there? Big or small, let us know. We just have to assume, like, from our soil sample, there's nothing there. And then little do we know, the minerals in that soil are living it up. They're dancing and right. moving and shaking.
Or eventually would have made life.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And then we don't make life on that planet. We don't send ourselves there. I'm losing track of what my thought I was going to say. Give me a second. It was good, too. So let me have another sip of this delicious Avatar.
I want to hear more about the sentient dark matter, though, because that's the first time I've heard this theory.
Okay, yeah, that's what I was getting at. So we can't knock on the planet, but perhaps dark matter is just waiting there like a riddle, like this puzzle that's expecting us to, one, kind of figure out what it is, and then go, oh, we were thinking there had to be this wormhole that opened up, and we were trying so hard to do that, and we were trying to warp and bend space-time. We didn't figure it out. Like, we just need to kind of tap dark energy and say, psst, hey, we're one of the things living inside you. We'd like to send one of our ships way out there, and we don't have the propulsion to do it. And dark energy go, why didn't you just ask? And then it grabs us in a little cocoon, and you won't even feel the effects of this, and sends us out, like, with an arm reach. Here you go, and sets us near Pluto.
And that'd be super convenient.
That'd be so convenient. And we just haven't figured out how to communicate it with it yet. It's so foreign to us. I mean, I think once we figure out dolphins and whales and
things. Baby steps all the way to dark matter.
Yeah, all the way up. Yeah, and then we get to dark matter and go, oh, this is a tricky one.
No, it's the whales. You can talk to the whales.
It'll all line up. You get them whales figured out, and then the whales go, oh, you want to talk to dark matter? I know that guy.
We've Boom. Known them forever.
Yeah. Whew, glad you reined me back in on that one. I almost lost it. I blanked a little bit. But yeah, there's probably nothing to that. But what if I always like to posit that perhaps that's what science needs, is an idiot throwing out ideas that science can go, well, that is dumb, but can we rule it out?
But that's actually, you know, very similar to how a lot of brainstorming sessions work, where, and we do these two brainstorming sessions, you can't say no to any idea, you write them all on the whiteboard or whatever, and there's some really idiotic ideas on their own. Uh-huh. But when you combine five idiotic ideas together, you get a really good idea. You're like, well, that's dumb, except for that one small point of that one. That one, okay, we'll take that, and that's how you get a really good idea.
Oh,
so
okay.
You need these really far out brainstorming sessions, and there's a lot of institutes that do it.
I would love to see the jokes that you guys come up with when, if you do say to the JPL guys, like, do you think we could communicate with dark energy? And they'd be like, what would they be, binary codes? Would there be a series of like Morse code? I mean, where
would
you start?
It would depend who you talk to. As you mentioned before, depending on the level of the spectrum, if you get an interesting response or a two-page thesis.
Yeah. I hope you'll fire back, send me some results if there are any. So the universe itself, the thing we live in, this cage, this exploratory maze that we're trapped in, this one part of it that we're harnessed to that we haven't even seen all of it.
This tiny, tiny, tiny part of the universe.
Tiny part. And even within that, there's a big element of it. Like, I would venture to say neither of us has seen or set foot on Antarctica.
Correct.
You've been in Paris. You've been to CERN. Was it Switzerland and Paris kind of, or France, Switzerland kind of area?
Yeah, CERN is right on the border between France and Switzerland.
Okay, so you've seen some of the world. I've seen some of the world. There's infinitely much more of it that I haven't seen. Absolutely. And will never see. And that's a strange feeling to know that one day I will die and go, I barely saw any of that. I just saw hardly any. And yet I felt like I was in a maze or a fun house, depending on how you look at it. You get trapped down by bills and work. You know, I'm not going to go see this house I live in. I live in this house. They make me work in this one room. And even more so, like one closet that I'm in.
In my one cubicle.
In my one cubicle, in that closet. How do I get out of here and go open all these doors and see this whole house? And then open the front door and go, and see how big it is out there. And that's kind of a world that you're kind of in that space of seeing out that front door.
Well, we try. I mean, that's what, you know, we're slowly but surely trying to open up those doors, windows, however you want to look at it. But there's still so much we don't know, don't understand. I mean, you know, with all our technology, as you said before, we recently think we just discovered another planet. So, like, yeah. It just goes to show. And that's in our neighborhood, so to speak, if we're looking at, you know, on a galactic kind of scale. So this, you know, who knows what the heck else is going on in the universe and what we don't understand and what we can't reach or like.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I said before, yeah, that's the motivation just to work harder. Like, for me, that's why it's so cool, because there's just so many unknowns and let's try and understand some of them.
In the last one, we touched a little bit on like that you went to Israel and that you maintain like a certain level of like attachment to like Judaism, and but not necessarily obviously devoutly religious, and there, I guess there are a couple schools of atheism. There is nothing, and then there's kind of that agnostic side of it, like, well, there could be, I just don't know what it is, so I am acknowledging there is nothing that I know of. Why would a God make this? Like, just hypothetically, how would it design it, and what is the purpose? What do you think, like, why create a universe?
I mean, on the sarcastic level, there's so many great comments being like, and let's throw this lie in that we'll never figure out and see. It's so complicated.
It feels like that, right? There's just so many red herrings. Like, right. Let's fire a comet past them.
Let's see how they react. Yeah, there's the ninth planet, no ninth planet, new ninth planet. See how they react. But yeah, I mean, it's a super complicated design. And definitely, you know, if we're going down that route, that something designed the universe and imparted these rules and things like that, they're way more intelligent than we were to be able to define all these things. And just, they had some view, and it's not a simple one.
But what if your overall consciousness could get to a level where, like, they trusted you? And they being this mystical thing we don't know about, and they went, Jason, you did it. Good, come in here. And you step in this room, and it's blank whiteness, and they go, you can create a world whenever you want. The questions that a God pre-making a world would ask his or herself would be immense. Like, what do I want people to achieve from this? What do I want, or even not even people, just the beings? Do I want there to be life? What do I want life to? Do I want it to be a video game where they race to the end and go,
right,
solved it?
But or is it just like making a web page now and you can go to like Squarespace and be like, all right, so what do I want in my world? And I'm not going to worry about the code behind it. It could be super complicated.
Yeah.
But like, I want them to eventually have houses. Yeah, that sounds nice.
Yeah, it's like a sim world.
Yeah,
just drag and drop in. Ooh, mountains.
They don't see the code behind it. They don't know how ridiculous complicated it is.
There's something to that, right? I mean, we replicate on like the microcosm element of the things we find, the things we solve. Do you see that in a way where, oh yeah, that seems largely how the world was made and why it was made, and here we are doing exactly that. We're replicating it.
Yeah, so for me, I guess my thought process never goes back to that's how the world was made. It's more just focusing on how, like, what is it made of, so to speak, and like how do things interact. It's whenever there's something I don't understand or something we finally do understand, I guess for me, my thought process never goes back and says like, oh, some magical being must have made it that way. It's like, oh, no, now we just understand how it works. And that's now let's try and understand why it evolved that way. Or, you know, where we'll never, you know, in our lifetime understand like some of these things and like why the strong force developed the way it was or stuff like
that.
Well,
not with that attitude.
Well, yeah, true.
We can solve it.
But yeah, I see what you're saying. Like those gaps, those, where does gravity just suddenly disappear and not factor into the forces?
Gravity is a great one that like, you know, there's still so many unknowns about gravity and what, how, like, why does one planet know the other planet's there? How is gravity actually transmitted and things like that, and gravitational waves that we have more recent data on. So they're just really interesting questions. And it's, yeah, I mean, I would also find it very hard to believe that some other thing was like, I'm going to program in every single little part of this.
Yeah, it does seem much more drag and drop. Like, gravity, what's that? Might as well throw it in there.
They'll figure it out.
The people used to really get after me on a previous podcast I did because I would say things that they would, that's a logical fallacy. The lack of evidence doesn't mean there is evidence. But I have a hard time with that because I feel like, so Bill Cosby not filing slander lawsuits against every woman is in a way a bit of evidence that there's something there. He should be attacking and saying, I'm completely innocent. Because he is not, then you can rationalize or, you know, extend from there, like, something must be going on. And that's how I look at it, of like, so the okay, so it was just nothingness, and then if there was a Big Bang, but what was before that? And what would compel someone to do it? And even those two tiny particles headed towards each other in nothingness, who flicked them?
How did they get there?
Yeah, yeah. How did they get set in motion? And it goes back to like CERN almost, with like, there's a magician. There's
there is the magic black box over there.
Yeah.
The universe creator.
Yeah. I don't feel like that's a logical fallacy. I feel like there's something to, like, to be an atheist means you have to, there was a big bang and that it's all a big accident. Like, okay, but prior to that, like, what before that?
I mean, to me, being an atheist is more, you know, it comes hand in hand with admitting you don't understand things. And to me, it's more, you know, I should be a good person to be a good person. I don't need someone magically telling me to be a good person. And there's so many things we don't understand. And I'd rather leave that question as unanswered and be like, no, I don't understand. Versus, oh, here's a simple solution. There was a magical being that threw two particles together and then we had a universe.
I'm, yeah.
Like, I'd rather be like, well, we don't know. Let's try and figure it out. And that might be the answer. Like,
yeah.
We can't disprove, you know, that right now, which is not a good road to go down. But who knows? I'd rather leave it as we don't understand. We're working on it.
I feel like that's a healthy human way to live on the planet. All the things you've said, like, well, I don't know. I'm here. If I spend all my time thinking about it, I'm going to go crazy. So I might as well just enjoy it, have fun with it, explore, try to, like, better my mind and my body. Yet there's also a part of me that wishes, like, everyone at JPL was kind of thought there was someone who flicked the particles and went, we're coming for you.
We're going to find you. We're going to harness your source of energy. And then we'll be fine as a human race.
Exactly. We know you did this. You screwed up a lot of it. What is going on with these orphans? What is going on? We're coming. We got a lot of questions.
We're coming for you.
I wish that was the mission statement of JPL.
I don't think we'd be funded if that was our mission statement.
Have you heard about this weird rogue group out in the...
Oh, yeah. We destroyed their contract. Don't worry about them. They're no more. They're all fired.
I wouldn't say envious. I enjoy my life and existence, but it really is nice to... meet with people and chat with them that are having just cool lives, cool existences, you know, people that are traveling around the world or photographing odd things or exploring, designing, whatever it may be, that are really taking advantage of how crazy it is to be alive.
Whatever keeps people happy, that's my big one. So, you know, be happy with what you do and be motivated and then have fun.
Man, I think you're doing a great job of it. We should probably wind this down. I have finished my avatar, Jasmine, from Elysium Brewing.
I'm on my last job.
Oh, you're nearly there. It's it grew on me. I would recommend it. If you're new to Elysium Brewing, try it out. Any last things you want to get in? I mean, is there anything you left out? You got your PhD from Caltech. We barely touched on that.
That's fine.
And what was your thesis? What was the overall drive of it?
My thesis ended up being on basically computational fluid dynamics, so fluid mechanics on a computer for hypersonics, so things that go really fast.
Just like everyone really always does.
Exactly, standard computational fluid dynamics for hypersonics, reacting flows. Basically, like, heat shields for astronauts, so, like, Apollo 13, when they're coming back and all the flames around the capsule, making sure the astronauts don't blow up.
Whoa.
But looking at, like, the tiniest, smallest, fundamental question of what's the chemistry like when the air is so hot and you have a heat shield and they interact and what the heck happens there.
And how do you test that?
There are some experiments that are done. You can do them in a chem lab with some representative materials, heat them up, and then kind of take samples of what comes off and be like, huh, is that what we thought it was? Let's look at the computer. Do they match? Yeah, they're close. All right.
I wish you were just playing with little models, like through fire.
So there are some ground testing facilities where we do that. At Caltech, some of my friends who worked, it's called T5, but it's, you know, a facility that shades the building that tries to recreate re-entry conditions for very short periods of time to look at, you know, how hot does a capsule get? What does the flow look like around it? Are they going to flip over? Is this bad?
Mm-hmm.
So, and you get to press a really big button, and then the whole building shades, which is awesome.
Oh, cool. Nice. Man, that's fun. It's like you got to do what I feel like little boys more so than little girls. And I don't mean to be exclusive there, but that is, as a former little boy, like, that's
it
the
was,
best.
Like, I worked in a combustion lab at undergrad, so I got to light things on fire for science, which was amazing. And, like, the first time I worked there, the postdoc was like, here's your blowtorch and here's your fire extinguisher. Have both of these whenever you run your experiment. I'm like, all right.
I've made it.
Yes.
Ah, 8-year-old baby, so proud of me. That is fantastic. Well, I hope you'll, if you ever would like to come back, you're welcome anytime. I hope you would.
You.
This was really fun, and thanks for doing it. And
thank you for having me.
Of course, yeah, this is great. Jason Rabinovich, thanks for dropping by, visiting the Space Cave. Come back, and I'd love to come up and see the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
I will get you a tour. I'll let you know.
Yes. All right, cool. All right, let's go ahead and wind this down. Well, that's it. Pretty great talking to these genius types, and Jason... Really, cool guy? Man, I gotta get better at that.
Well, it's fun talking with these cool guys. Like talking with these cool guys.
Anyway, I enjoyed the conversation. I hope you did as well. And if you know someone that you think would be a good guest, let me know. If you know someone who has a band or some music they're trying to get out into the world, let me know. And or if you just want to chat, lots of things you can do. You don't have to do anything, though. Thanks for rating and subscribing. And the audio from One-Headed Beast is officially on iTunes. So if you'd like to own it as just a digital album, you can do that. And of course, if you want the whole project, which is animation and the audio and me in one version of it, that's at davidhunsberger.com. You can stream it and download that there. All right, let's get out of here with some music from a friend of mine who... is a fantastic musician out of Minneapolis, and played a bunch of his stuff in the early stages of the podcast, and now he's got some new projects coming down. This one is called Rebels of Our Own Kind. This is from Charlie Van Stee. Thanks for stopping by the Space Cave.